So, what's this Arb League thing all about? I heard it's this new type of educational programming that's taking over the globe, where they talk with real arborists, artisans, and scientists about their journey and what we can learn from them to better understand and appreciate trees in our surroundings. This is our dialogue with trees. This is the Arb League. The man said he'd been pruning trees since the 1970s. He said he had proof in his pocket. He pulled out a crumpled up piece of paper and handed it to me. I unraveled it, half expecting it to fall to pieces. But it was held together by 49 years worth of sweat, bar oil, and wood chips. So I gently unraveled the piece of paper to reveal the text. I kind of wiped away the sawdust to reveal the text. I half expected to see it in some ancient script like cuneiform or hieroglyphics. That didn't end up being the case. In fact, it was in English, and I could understand it. At the very top of the page, I could see the words, pruning fundamentals. Those are words that sing to my soul. That's the stuff I like to see. Maybe this old bag of bones is onto something. I look a little bit closer. Smaller text, I see the words, December 1975, and Dr. Richard Harris. I recognize that name. In fact, I think he had authored a few books that I had read throughout the years to try to hone in my craft, become the person I am today. This old man's got treasure in his pocket. So we look in a little bit closer, see what kind of keys to the kingdom can be unraveled in this piece of document. Well, sure enough, it had that typical kind of Dr. Harris flair to it. Things about apical control, apical dominance, X currents, D currents, all this kind of stuff that's mostly just useful to the specialist. Or perhaps a salesperson can use this cryptic language to impress a client or to woo a prospective mate. You know, the kind of words you can string together into incoherent sentences that sound smarter than you actually are. Something like, apical dominance this, apical control that. Your tree has that rounded D-current growth habit. Let's go ahead and prune it to get those plant hormones stirred up, those auxins bopping around, doing things they otherwise wouldn't, while we make it more sensuous in appearance and erect in that X-current style. We part with a blush, contract consummated. Now we dig a little bit closer, a little bit deeper into this document. Oh, there's stuff I recognize that we still do today. Holy smokes, this is an ancient treasure trove. We get into the whole reason for pruning trees, cutting them up, lopping off bits. You know, that's what pruning really is, as a matter of fact. Removing some of those branches, the leaves, flowers, fruits, twigs, all that kind of stuff. Just wounding up, cutting up, and dicing into that thing to try to get it to do something you want. Well, here Dr. Harris then makes a special note that each tree kind of has a propensity to grow a certain way, whether it's that rounded or decurrent if you want to impress a client, or that more straight growing like a pine tree, that X-current style. Either way, there's some spectrum of growth that some species or cultivars have that we need to respect when we are looking at them and pruning them to do certain things we want. I feel a sharp nudge as the old man elbows me to get my attention. He's looking at me with his toothless smile and leather skin. He grabs a document and stuffs it in his pocket. Behind him, the tree comes into focus. The top has been lopped off without regard to natural structure of the tree. Ah, blasphemy. Didn't you learn anything from the document you've been carrying around for 49 years? He says, I can't read hieroglyphics. So there you have it. The answers are within our grasp, but mean nothing if we don't take time to understand it.
Tune in next week as Climber Zero finds himself transported to 1975 amidst a cloud of pesticides. Up next on our program, we have Dan Timms from a recording of February 14th, 2023. Stay tuned.
Dan is an artist in the trees, an artist of the written and spoken word, a mentor, a business owner, a father, a partner, and all of these things, and also multiple time guest on the Live Tree Talks presentation series, and it will be four times on Friday, this Friday, February 17th, but this is going to be coming out way after that, so it doesn't mean anything to you guys right now out there listening, but Live Tree Talks will be coming up almost 3 years to the week, Dan. Can you even believe that? Last one. So, yeah, so that's Dan. Dan is here, very influential here in the community, mentored a lot of folks, and welcome, Dan. Thanks for coming into the show.
Thanks for having me. You got a brilliant little studio here, Ryan.
You like the plants dangling from the ceiling?
Yeah, I didn't even notice they were fake at first. So.
Yeah, I shouldn't have told you. There's no light in here, though, so they would just die anyway. That's house plants for me.
Yeah, they're not trees, you know. I only have respect for large, you know, plants.
Fake plants or trees. Yeah, exactly. So, Dan, you're actually from kind of the Chico, California area originally, right? Kind of that area?
Well, that's close. Yeah. If you drew a line from Chico straight west to the coast, I grew up in a town, Fort Bragg, California.
Okay.
A couple hundred miles north of San Francisco.
Cool. And so you had mentioned, we were having beers a couple weeks ago, and you mentioned you never thought you were going to leave the ocean. And so what was kind of that journey that brought you to Lawrence, Kansas, of all places? Would you say?
Oh, gosh, I've got to dig deep to remember that trajectory. So, the ocean was a huge part of my life, diving, surfing, fishing. Again, the butt of almost every joke we had growing up was Kansas. You know, hey, man, you're not a coaster. You're from Kansas sort of deal. So my undergraduate degree in the Central Valley, spent some time, and again, this might be circuitous, like lived in France for a year, which is where I started doing tree work on a farm. Came back to California and settled in the Bay Area. And it's funny, I was one of 400 applicants for a brush dragging job in the Berkeley area. And I had fought forest fires, so I knew a little bit about a chainsaw, and worked for this tree service, the Forest Tree Company in Berkeley, California. And I thought it was the funniest thing. The two owners of this business, their names were Rick Elephant and Marshall Lyons. And they both had masters in arboriculture and forestry. And I thought, that is just the weirdest thing, to go to college, Cal Berkeley of all places, and study trees. Like, shit, you just climb up on a ladder and cut the limbs off. But I worked for them. And
what year was this roughly?
So this might have been 92, 93.
Okay. I would have been about 6 years old or so, 6, 7.
I was holding it out there in the real world for you, cutting trees. And again, like a completely different world, arboriculture was at that time. One of the bosses, Rick Elephant, had been a smoke jumper, fire crew. And I think that kind of got me the job because I'd fought forest fires. And so all the equipment we used and the techniques were descended from, the way you got out of a 200-foot red cedar when you had parachuted into it. So this really rudimentary equipment, like hemp ropes, that sort of thing.
Wow.
From there, I distinctly remember this being like really grubby in my Ben Davis workwear and like working somewhere near the campus and dirty. And I saw this, young guy walk out of an office. He had a leather briefcase and a tweed coat, maybe a copy of Carl Sandburg tucked under his arm. And I was like, oh, the hell with this work thing. I'm going back to graduate school. So went to graduate school for a while in Boulder, Colorado. And there was an epic ice storm maybe in the year 93, 94, and my absentee landlord at the time had an electric chainsaw in the attic, and a willow tree had fallen into the house. And so I was like, hey, I could clean that up for you. And I did, and the neighbor came running over like, hey, I have a tree on my house too. Like, could you cut that off? And I think for like $50 a day, which I thought was great, I like just started going down the block with this electric chainsaw and helping people with their trees, and started Shamrock Tree Service there. And then from there, oh gosh, what did I do? I dropped out of graduate school, went back east with my partner at the time, Had a tree service in Northampton, Massachusetts. Spent a year in Maine, where, you know, what I always say about doing business in Maine was that the second I opened my mouth and they heard that I was not from around there, lost 9 out of 10 jobs.
Oh, man.
I did that. And then that same partner had an internship for a year at the Menninger Foundation in, what, Kansas. Like, whoa. Okay, man, I'm going to hang out in Kansas for a year and then I'll go back to the ocean. And that was 26 years ago now.
Came here and never came back.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And so Shamrock, so I guess I didn't realize that Shamrock was started in Colorado. So that was there, moved to Maine and then came, and then you're still running it today here in
Colorado, Massachusetts, Maine. I think I got my real bump. They had like the once in a century ice storm in Northampton. And I was living in Maine, and one of my customers tracked me down and told me, like, come back here. Like, this is – and it was. I think it was something like 90% of the mature trees in the area had at least some damage. Maybe 20, 30% got wiped out, which is also interesting. Like, at the time, if you had, you know, a tree that had been torn up with a few branch stobs on it, like, you remove that son of a bitch. And we don't do that anymore. We make, you know, some funky stob cuts, and the root system is good. It keeps going. But, yeah, like, really launched into it with that ice storm. So, yeah, and then back to Kansas here, and, yeah, I've been here ever since.
Well, I'm glad that trajectory occurred. It's been pretty great. Because, I mean, I remember, you know, when I was kind of a fresh arborist, you know, seeing your trucks around, you know, 15 years ago or whenever I started getting into this and seeing your DIY like trucks. And it was kind of almost like a boutique. I hate to use the word like hipster, but kind of like a boutique hipster type of thing. I was like, that's just so cool. And it inspired my chip truck as well, the design on that. So, but I just remember being, that was a very cool thing seeing as a young person coming up into the profession kind of from afar. And I mean, through that process, I mean, you've mentored, I mean, dozens to several people who have since stayed in the profession or left the profession, maybe started businesses, stopped businesses, and so on and so forth. What does that kind of feel like for you, like having had that kind of impact, do you think?
Well, it's interesting, you know, and I remember being the new guy and flying under the radar and like basically running this pirate ship with just my dad and I and like passing out flyers all around town. And I was like, wow, you know, one day maybe I'll belong with these legit folks. And so then in the course of, well, it's been like 27 years here, like many of those businesses that were around, I always say like most of the key players in Lawrence at the time I moved here are either in prison for life or dead.
Wow.
At this point. And they've been replaced by a completely different class of arborists such as yourself, you know, and in that time, you know, I've stuck around. And another, you know, morbid thought is I've gone through two generations of wonderful customers who are, you know, maybe about 70, have great trees that they loved, took a chance on a fresh-faced little dude, and in 27 years have moved on. And, you know, the world keeps turning itself over. And also, you know, training people, you know, it's like being a parent in a way. You start off, you know, afraid of heights, don't know anything.
And overly confident, maybe.
Yeah. Well, there's overconfident and underconfident. But, you know, then you see people like learn and surpass you and go on to do things in a way you never expected possible. And it's, you know, it's like sort of a sensitive subject because I'm both very proud of those people, and it's a feeling of great accomplishment, but also many of the people I've trained have become my competitors, and you know, and so that happens in life. It's interesting to watch it unfolding, you know, and it's also interesting too. I think the best teacher is experience, and for us the best teacher is a tree that you've worked on. And you've watched it grow. You've watched it callus over from your cuts. You see the real reactions of what you've done to it. And if you climb that tree 10 times over 20-some-odd years, like, you learn a little something.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can also empathize with that now as in the, you know, 15 years or so, and you get that re-entry into a tree or something like that, and you can see, did it work? Did it not work? You know, maybe this is, you know, something that we probably won't do in the future and things like that. And so, yeah, I can definitely empathize with that. And so it's really cool to see the practices, the pruning practices or whatever that may or may not have worked. And then, in fact, I don't know if you've seen this as well, a few removals that early on in my career before I had chip trucks and things like this, you know, doing the removal, giving a discount for cutting and leaving it. And those logs are still there 15 years later in the yard. Stuff like that. And so it's just kind of cool to see the arc of the
the natural world doing its thing to either, I don't know, heal itself and go on and thrive, or, you know, decay and send out a lot of stem suckers. You know, the wood that sits there and becomes part of the world again in a different form.
Yeah.
The same bosses in Berkeley, I remember they're saying that primarily what they did doing tree work was to accelerate a natural cycle. Like that was what they were most comfortable with. You know, that a tree will form deadwood in the lower canopy, which is natural, and eventually it would fall off anyways. And so, hey, as an arborist, the most benign thing you can do is you're speeding up that cycle. That, and to sort of, I guess, reveal the tree to people, who, you know, it's covered in vine, there's tangled deadwood, you cannot stand under it and look up into the architecture of it. And, you know, when I think of tree work that way, that pleases me, that you really, you cause people to be able to see their tree. And, you know, sometimes, hey, maybe you screw it up because you over prune it, you know, and that's, you know, you have to wrestle with that a little bit, the respect for the tree, but also people's perceptions and opinions about their own trees, which you have to respect. Like it or not, they own this massive living creature. And so it's always this kind of dialogue between what you think is right and what you might do and what a customer wants to do with their tree. And it's this compromise you quite often strike. I don't know if you have that experience where...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, trying to reconcile the desires or wants of the client with what may or may not be best practice. And then sometimes if they dig in really, really hard, you know, finding that middle ground that's, you know, works out for everybody. And then there are times to just walk away from the job too, you know, topping trees, stuff like that. But certainly, you know, it's, I've had that experience as well. And now I kind of try to avoid those people that are difficult to work with, because, you know, at a point where I kind of can.
Just tell them you're backlogged 8 months.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I'm not the kind of person, I won't elevate a price, but yeah, it's certainly if I get a sense that they're difficult to deal with, because I've had some of those in the past, that have taught me valuable life lessons and valuing my time and my expertise as well. And so, you know, if somebody's going to be super difficult to work with, then, or maybe ignore any, you know, advice we may give to a point that it's super detrimental to the tree, then it might be something that I walk away from.
Well, yeah, I have these own internal policies where I will, in general, I'll say what I think once. If I really like the person and I think they're interested in listening, I might say it two or three times. And then there are folks who I'll just walk away. Like, I don't want to kill that magnificent bur oak because it's a mess. On the other hand, there's also this, like, kind of – and you're very moral and ethical. But, like, okay, that's a living. That's shoes for my kids, right?
Yep.
And if I don't do it, somebody else will. So it's a little bit like, I don't know, if you're a meat eater, you know, and you go out and hunt an animal and you put an arrow to it and you thank it for its sacrifice and you, you know, you have this honor for it, as opposed to, like, you know, just consuming something that somebody else killed that's mass produced. And I kind of feel like, well, if this tree is going to die, rather it be me that kills it.
Yeah, yeah.
Reuse its body, you know, for various purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of that, you know, that I think we've largely here in Lawrence, at least just with the connections we've made with a lot of the tree services and stuff, I think we've really gotten hopefully for the most part beyond that, where, you know, early on here or anywhere really, that if somebody approaches you, top this tree or whatever it is, if I don't do it, they're going to do it, so might as well get paid to do it kind of mentality. And I've seen communities that are like that. But I think, fortunately, I think now we're kind of at a point here in this town and with the kind of folks that live here in this community that once they're equipped with that idea, I don't think they necessarily want to harm the tree. And we've got a lot of ethical folks now that it's less likely that that's going to happen. If you walk on it, if they're like, we're topping this no matter what, that's what we want, that's the scope of work, we're paying you to do this. And then if you say, well, is there anything I can do to convince you not to do that, and then walk away, I'm pretty confident now it's going to be a slow or a small likelihood that they're going to find somebody that will do that. It will happen probably. But, you know, eventually if they get 5, 6, 7 companies saying, you know, don't, that's not a great idea, most people will generally acquiesce. And of course, there are people who are just really stubborn and just want what they want, and you're at their beck and call. But,
well, you know, in full disclosure here too, I do top some trees. And, you know, interestingly, in a Hail Mary situation, it's maybe a valid way, especially a Bradford pear. I mean, I don't know if the existence of Bradford pears is valid, but, like, gosh, the more harshly you treat them, amber maples, sometimes I feel about that way too. Yeah. Like, all right, you can keep this thing on this weird contorted life support. Oh, so
yeah, absolutely. And Bradford pears, I like to top those, but I like to top them at ground level.
The one cut pruning solution.
Yeah, I like to prune those. That is something, and for those of you listening out there, you know, if you're an arborist and you've seen Bradford pears, you're well aware of their pain to manage. But we also do get a lot that have been topped in the past. And so you basically get to a point where you're kind of pollarding them or doing something. Uh-huh. You know, they'll sprout profusely. And, you know, if that management was done and then trying to inherit that and deal with that, they're challenging trees. So I would say just, you know, if you've got one, remove it. get rid of it. But, you know, they certainly can be. That's a species or a group of trees where I've seen, you know, in areas where they will get head cut pretty frequently and stuff. And we try to avoid as much as possible, but there's a bunch that have been, you know, topped that then dealing with the sprouting, is quite a challenge, you know?
Well, and I feel obligated to say here, you know, they're a scourge of the natural ecosystem. Now that they go rogue, and the local arborist is telling the story that, you know, for a long while, you know, he put all his debris on a big trailer and take it out, and he had 120 goats, and which would take a brush pile and eat every limb up to about an inch in diameter.
Of course, Sean.
And then you could burn that brush pile. I thought, well, hey, maybe your team of goats could pull the trailer too. But anyways, I mean, the take home of that was they wouldn't eat Bradford pears. And a goat will they'll eat anything. But like, this is an unnatural creature. Yep, is genetically engineered to fall apart, smells like bleach in the springtime. And, you know, now, hey, we learned comes up with these thorny, nasty little progenitors that are just immune to everything, insect pests and all that. And so, like, hey, yeah, there's a species I don't mind. You know, it's like I don't do any herbicides. I don't do chemicals on principle. However, you know, if you have poison ivy crawling up your tree and you're highly allergic to it, yeah, there's one case where maybe the use of Roundup is justified. So I'm completely immune to it, but it gets me in trouble with my family as I have poison ivy oil. So, you know, and I don't know, like, hey, we can get like down a rabbit hole on just about any subject related to trees, but you know, it's an interesting question. What's the difference between pollarding, which is a time-honored and really clever way of managing trees, especially in an urban environment, and topping? And my flippant answer is it's about how soon you started and how much you do it.
Yep, and the size of the cuts
right.
And the frequency of the reentry, for sure. I'd agree with that.
Well, I always point out, like, you know, in some American cities, actually in D.C., I noticed, like, Bradford pears are standard street tree, and they cut the bejesus out of them. They pollard them every year. If you go to Europe, it's like, you know, you have these plane trees typically are a species that does really well. They're hundreds of years old, 10 feet tall, dense umbrella-like canopy of shade over your, you know, sidewalk cafe, and really pretty safe, like zero fear of failure in a, you know, really crowded area. So, you know, we get these ideas that are sacrosanct. Like I mentioned, you know, like, oh my goodness, this tree's been damaged by a storm. Like, we have to take this thing out. And then a few years down the road, you're like, that's total bullshit.
This concludes our programming for this evening. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. See you then.